Welcome to the Speech Uncensored podcast. I'm Leanne, your host, and today's topic is outpatient swallow diagnostics, getting the whole picture. And my guest today is Isabel Ramadi. I'm really excited for this because I love outpatient. And so we're going to be talking about video swallow studies, fluoroscopy or modified barium swallow studies, in the realm of it coming as an outpatient. So patients coming into the hospital and getting the diagnostics there. And there's unique circumstances surrounding that, rather than if you're working in acute care or inpatient rehab, you often know that patient, you have a relationship with that patient, you've already done a chart review, and you just wing them over to radiology. Whereas outpatients can come in with a completely absent case history, for example. So I'm really thrilled that Isabel is joining me today, and she's going to talk about how she approaches this study with these folks and all the different ways she makes it complete so that we're getting the whole picture and we're not missing things. Because, you know, I feel like sometimes our patients can come in and give us their concerns and what brings them in, but that's not actually what's going on in their body, and it can be misleading and we might miss something. So we're going to unpack that. Welcome, Isabel. So happy to have you.
Thank you so much, Leanne. I'm excited to be here.
Yes. Okay. So before we dive into our topic, I want to learn a little bit more about you. So tell me who you are, where you are, and all the things that you do.
Okay. So my name is Isabel Ramadi. I am a medical speech pathologist. I live in South Florida. I have worked primarily in acute care throughout my career, and I've also done outpatient imaging pretty consistently, at least for the past 14 years. I own a mobile fees company in South Florida, and I also work PRN at a level one trauma center and comprehensive stroke center. Outside of work, I do other fun things. I guest lecture at a local university on the topic of instrumental assessments. I've been doing that for about 4 years now, and it's something that I really enjoy. I also have recently connected with a lot of SLPs in South America, and that has allowed me to collaborate with a lot of them and also with some professional organizations down there. And that has given me the opportunity to participate in some educational activities where we share knowledge about, I've talked a lot about fees, I've talked a lot about the use of the free water protocol, and maybe other things that perhaps are SLP colleagues in South America are not using. And there are some things that are done a little bit differently there. So I've been able to share with them how we do things here and what has worked for us. Part of that collaboration with South American SLPs includes an international journal club that I run over Instagram. I do that completely in Spanish, which is my first language, but that has been quite challenging because I learned everything here. So translating everything, all the medical terminology to Spanish has been challenging, but I'm getting better every day. And I'm excited to have that opportunity to disseminate knowledge that maybe it's a little bit harder for them to get over there because of maybe lack of access to journals or just information in general. So I love doing that. And I'm excited that I'm able to do that every month with them.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love that.
Thank you.
I love in your introduction how you talked about you've been doing modified barium swallow studies for like the last, what'd you say, like 14 years?
Yes.
And you're also doing fees. And so you're getting to experience like both worlds and see how they both work in assessing the swallow and their different pluses. Some are better for doing an esophageal sweep, right? Like fees can't do that, but modifieds can. So I really like how you have the perspective to talk about modified barium swallow studies, like knowing both sides of that spectrum and being able to like really, I don't know, like assess like all the different patients that one would really work for over the other. So I'm probably getting ahead. All right. So let's start at the beginning.
Yeah, no, but going back to that thought, it is important to keep in mind that some patients actually will benefit from both studies. And while patients that have a more vague complaint of a swallowing disorder, maybe they can't really, the doctor is not able to determine what the patient's complaint is exactly. Those patients may benefit more from a modified barium swallow initially. Both fees and the MBS provide valuable information to assess the patient. And some patients will require both. And I have, in mostly in the acute care setting, done that a lot of times, sometimes on the same day, because having both tests allows you to answer your clinical questions better and more accurately so that we can help the patient.
Excellent. Awesome. All right. So when we're doing outpatient video swallow studies, let's set the stage. Tell me a little bit about like how those patients present. I think also just how it's different from doing these swallow studies when it's acute or inpatient rehab or something like that.
Okay, so when we see the patients in acute care, typically, ideally, we have seen the patient for a clinical swallow evaluation. So we have seen, we know the history of the patient, we have seen their behavior a little bit, we know a little bit about how much support they have from their family, how independent they are, and we have access to all of their imaging and all of their medical information. When the patient comes to the outpatient setting, since I work in a hospital, sometimes I do have that information from previous admissions and I can review previous tests that they have had even as outpatients. But sometimes they're new to the hospital and I really know nothing about them. So you really have to get a very thorough case history in order to be able to help them and understand what's happening and make referrals if it's necessary. And I think we have to recognize that responsibility we have, especially with those patients that come from the community, patients that have never been seen by a speech therapist, an outpatient, or have never had any assessments with a speech pathologist. And they just come to us referred by their PCP or maybe their GI or their neurologist. They come to us for our guidance and for our expertise as swallowing specialists. Sometimes they're very uncomfortable. They could be losing weight, they could be just annoyed with a persistent cough, or because they can't really enjoy their meals with their family, or they can't go to dinner with their friends because they're embarrassed, it takes forever for them to eat, or they're coughing constantly and they have to run to the bathroom because they're regurgitating food. So it's our responsibility to do a very thorough, comprehensive assessment so that we can help our patients improve their swallowing function, their quality of life, their overall health, and answer the questions to the best that we can.
I'm here for this.
Yeah. So part of being able to do a thorough assessment includes, you know, doing a good review of the history, taking a look at all of their symptoms, how they're impacting their quality of life, their nutrition, and their health. Also knowing the normal anatomy and physiology of the swallow mechanism. Knowing about the aging swallow, presbyphagia, what happens when we age, and recognizing that as not a disorder, but as changes that are related to normal aging. Also having some knowledge about the impact of medical conditions on the swallow mechanism, the impact of some medications, and also staying current with the research on new techniques or new findings, new therapeutic approaches, and very important also to be knowledgeable about what are some of the risks that could put the patient at higher risk for aspiration-related pulmonary complications. So I think you have covered here in your podcast before the predictors of aspiration pneumonia by Dr. Susan Langmore, and we know that there are some factors that predispose patients to pulmonary consequences if they have dysphagia. And there are some factors that are, let's say, more protective. So we have to be aware of all of those and put the results of the study into context so we can make the most appropriate recommendations for our patients.
Agreed.
Yeah, so why don't we talk a little bit about the patient interview?
I'm just going to hop in and I'm going to ask a question, if that's all right.
Yeah, that's fine.
All right. So you've covered the SLP's mm-hmm. responsibilities when we're conducting the outpatient video swallow studies. So now let's move into the realm where the patient has come into the hospital. They're sitting in the chair. They're ready to go. We walk in. So I guess this is where it could diverge. If they have a chart with our hospital in the computer, then we're probably able to review it before we walk in the room. Sometimes they don't, so there's not a whole lot we can get before we walk in the room. So let's kind of set this stage to where we were able to get some information, but we still have questions. And so we walk in and we want to interview the patient. Like, what's your go-to routine that you do when you are mining for information?
Okay, so before the patient even gets there, I review my schedule ahead of time. And I look to see if there's any information that I can gather from the patient from past medical records. And also, I can look at the script and see exactly what the doctor wrote. Sometimes there is some information there that's important for us and what kind of doctor is referring them to. Sometimes mm-hmm. with the script, we get some information from the patient. That tends to be the exception more than the rule, at least in the area where we are. Perhaps we should reach out to those doctors and see if they can send that information. I guess we could do that. But sometimes there is some information available that the doctor will send that will give us an idea of what the patient is experiencing and some information about their medical history. But typically, you know, so I do that ahead of time. And then once the patient is in their x-ray suite, I like to start open-ended. Just ask them why they're there. I just want to know in their own words, what brought them there? What's bothering them? What's happening? And their responses vary a lot, obviously, from my wife just wanted me to come here. The doctor referred me, or they're really bothered by what's happening. And they just say, I can't stop coughing, or I'm having a lot of trouble swallowing all of a sudden. I don't know what's happening. I really want to know what's going on. So I let them tell me in their own words what's happening. And then we talk about the onset of the symptoms. When did these symptoms start? Did they coincide with a diagnosis of another medical condition? Did it start when they started taking a new medication? Or maybe when there was a change in condition, maybe a surgery, a recent admission to the hospital or something like that? Then we also talk about how the symptoms have changed. Have they worsened? Are they the same? If they have progressively worsened, then we have a pattern that we need to keep in mind there. What type of consistency they have most difficulty with. Patients that complain more about having difficulty with solids typically have more GI or esophageal issues. But it's that, you know, you start forming a hypothesis, but it could be very wrong, but it just gives you an idea of what things the patient is dealing with. We also ask, are there symptoms happening at every meal, frequently throughout the day, or just every now and then? Also, when they're having the symptoms, what happens? Are they choking? Are they gagging? Many patients will say, I'm choking. But once you ask more questions and you ask them, are you turning red? Is it difficult to breathe? And they just say, no, I'm just gagging. Or they can explain it a little bit better the more questions you ask. We also want to gather information about either a previous video swallow test or FEES or even a clinical swallow evaluation. If they've had any other relevant exams, like an EGD, an endoscopy, or an esophagram, or a recent chest x-ray or CT of the chest, any recent history of pneumonia, bronchitis, or upper respiratory infections. I always ask all of those questions because the patient that may be aspirating may not present with a full-blown pneumonia, but with other symptoms that are respiratory or pulmonary, but they could be, maybe they just classified it as bronchitis or they just have recurrent congestion. Another important question to ask is, of course, what kind of food they're eating? What's their diet? And many patients will say things like, I eat anything, but you may want to ask some questions about, you know, what kind of food they will eat for dinner. Are they modifying their diet in any way? Because the more questions you ask, sometimes there are patients that then start sharing maybe that their spouses cut their food really small, or they need to make their food very moist for them to be able to swallow in an efficient way. So asking if they have modified their diet, if they avoid certain foods, or if there are some foods that they just can't eat because it's too difficult for them to swallow, that gives you a little bit more information about what their what they're eating. We also want to ask information about recent weight loss that's not intentional. And then there are other things that you can observe or even ask about that relate to predictors of or risk factors for pneumonia, such as their mobility status, their independence status, their oral health, their habits, and other factors affecting pulmonary clearance. So we know that things like smoking affect pulmonary clearance and increase the risk for aspiration-related pulmonary complications. Other things, and I've been doing, this was a topic of one of my presentation at FLASHA, and things like COPD and asthma, cystic fibrosis, I have not seen a patient with cystic fibrosis in outpatient, but if you see them in the hospital, those patients have very compromised pulmonary clearance too. So those are some things to keep in mind. You also want to ask them if they're coughing throughout the day or only with meals. And questions such as, do they cough at night? Do they have a hoarse vocal quality in the morning? Things like that, that are pretty consistent with reflux. So you just want to know, have a little bit more information about that.
All of these questions are basically us determining what could be the cause, like, and we're like crossing things off. So like you mentioned, with if they're coughing more, they notice a higher frequency in the evening, that's probably more related to reflux. So then we know that they may not have like prandial aspiration, but they could be, if this is even the case for them, aspirating on reflux, or just that their complaints are related to reflux and they may not be aspirating at all. So like, all of these questions, we're determining where the cause is and if it is related to a problem that we can manage or not, or if there's other education or strategies that we could give them that will help them manage, like, basically their concerns, because their concerns might not actually be related to dysphagia.
It could be, and we're just forming a hypothesis, but patients are sometimes not very good about telling us, like, they have a hard time identifying exactly what's happening. And sometimes they complain of food getting stuck in their, and they point to their throat, and it's a lot lower down. So we know that patients are not very accurate in identifying exactly where the problem is. So what they tell us gives us a lot of information, but once we do the assessment, then we can put it all together. So doing this thorough case review can help us at the end put it all together, put all the pieces together, so that, you know, sometimes it's easy to determine what's wrong, and sometimes it's a little bit more of a gray area and we need to make other referrals so that the patient can be assessed maybe by GI or neurology so that they can get the help that they need. Mm-hmm. Okay, so
awesome.
Yeah, so then we need to get the medical history, and you may need to ask this in different ways, because at least in the area where I am, our patients are, I would say, an average of like 80, 85 years old, and they tend to forget certain things. So even now with COVID, I allow one of the caregivers to come with them if they feel like they will be better able to give me some more information about the patient's medical history. And I ask an open-ended question about their medical history, but then, you know, very often I have to ask specifically, do you take medications for any conditions? And then, you know, they bring out their list of medications. And then, you know, the more you do this, you get a little familiar with what medications are for each condition. I would just confirm with the patient just so we are not writing the wrong information. Also, you may want to mention different body parts. Like, do you see a neurologist, or do you get treated for any problems in your stomach? Just to remind them a little bit about conditions that they may be dealing with and being treated for that they may not recall. It's common to have a patient that tells you they've never had surgery, and then you turn the floor on and then you're like, oh wow, you had a 4-level anterior and posterior cervical fusion with instrumentation and that you forgot to tell me about. So that happens sometimes. So
yeah
or a lot of staples
tells a different story.
Yeah.
Like, they're all scattered and you're like, oh my goodness, is that shrapnel? Like, what's happening here?
So then, I had that surgery 20 years ago. But you may also want to ask what specialists they see And that can give you an idea. You can ask questions about what conditions are treated for by each one of those specialists. Sometimes they see the GI just because they get a routine colonoscopies, but they don't have any other issues. So you can ask a question what specialist you see and maybe just follow up with some questions about why they see that doctor. And then you want to know if there's a history of cancer, radiation, any new medications and things like that. So a couple of patient reported measures that I like to administer for our outpatient video swallow studies are the E10, which I'm pretty sure a lot of people are familiar with. But if you're not, the E10 is something you can Google and you'll get a free form that's very easy for the patient to fill out, very easy to understand. It's in layman's terms. And it is a scale with 10 items where the patients self-rate the severity of their symptoms. And I like to have this information because it tells you how they are affected by their symptoms. And sometimes they could have severe dysphagia and their score is a 0 or a 1, meaning they don't feel like it's affecting them at all. They don't think there's a problem. And sometimes it can be the opposite, where we don't find anything. There's no penetration, aspiration, residuals. The esophageal sweep doesn't show any retrograde flow, but the patient is very bothered by their symptoms.
I wanted to add something on to the EAT-10. Something that I like about it for documenting purposes and also like for that clinical decision-making process is that it has 10 questions, right? And then they score it on a Likert scale of 0 to 4,
yep.
4 being the most severe. So it has a potential of earning up to 40 points. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, or maybe I'll have to go back and read it again. But if they score a 3 or higher, like if they report anything as a 3 or higher, like that's an abnormal result.
That is. Yeah, that's right.
And then this one I'm not so certain on. I think it's 28, 25 or 28, maybe somewhere in that neighborhood. I'll have to go back and check. If they score around that point, then it is indicative that there's some percentage likely of experiencing aspiration, like significant dysphagia.
Yeah, I don't remember that cutoff score, but it's in the 20s. I know it's in the 20s. I don't remember exactly. But yeah.
Yes.
There's been this tool has been around for a while, and there's been a lot of reliability and validity studies on the scale. And we'll have to find that study so that we can find the exact information. Something I came across recently is the E10 for pediatrics. I don't know if you've seen that, but it's also obviously a 10 item scale, and it is a score of 4, I believe, is indicative of dysphagia. I think the article was something that came out recently, but it may be something to look for if you're doing pediatric swallow studies or even for the clinical evaluations to include as part of your assessment.
I'm so sorry. I'm going to interrupt you again because I looked it up because I actually wrote a post on the EAT-10. And so like I found all this information. Okay, so I was mistaken. So subjective dysphagia symptoms can predict an aspiration risk with a score of 15 or more. And that indicates that the patient is 2.2 times more likely to aspirate. And that was a study completed in 2015 cited like in that article or in that write-up that I did. So when we're thinking of the 20s, it's that if you get a patient with an EAT-10 score with a mean in the about 23, that's you're going to see that with patients with esophageal dysphagia. Patients with oropharyngeal dysphagia also score a mean around 23, 22 for those with head and neck cancer, and 11 for those with reflux. So like they've done studies with different groups of people, different types, and then they find where people with these issues are likely to be scoring. Mm-hmm. So I'll put that link in the show notes. It's a really easy read.
Thank you for clarifying that. If you have a lot of patients with head and neck cancer that come for you for outpatient video swallow studies, there's another scale by MD Anderson that it's a quality of life scale. So that may be more appropriate for that group as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know it's MDADI, I want to say.
Yeah. I like to call it the MDADI.
The MDADI.
Because nothing can be normal.
I didn't want to say that, but I call it the same.
Yeah, don't worry, girl. I'll say it. I'll put that out there.
yeah, so... The reflux symptom index is also a similar scale. It has 9 items, and they're scored in a scale from 0 to 5. And also it asks the patient within the last month, how did the following problem affect you? And it has items that relate to a hoarseness or clearing of the throat, difficulty swallowing pills, liquid, breathing difficulties, or persistent cough or phlegm. So for that, at a score of 13 or above is consistent, it's significant for reflux. So I like to have those two, and then we can, it's just a good measure to have as part of your assessment, and it's also maybe a good one to address again if the patient is recommended treatment, then maybe after a treatment cycle, maybe we can administer the same scales again and see if there's been some improvement. But it's nice to have the numbers so that we can add it to our documentation. So I just wanted to say that I know we've said that we've talked about a lot of questions and a lot of information to collect from our patients, but these two scales are things that perhaps you can give to your patients as part of their intake form so they can fill it out when they're filling out their information outside, they're filling out insurance information or waiting to be processed at the front desk, they can be filling out these scales so just to save time. So that's something that perhaps you can consider. Mm-hmm. One last piece of information that we will need is to do just a cranial nerve or oral motor and sensory exam. And we just want to have an idea. It's important to have this information so that we can look at things like asymmetry, reduced range of motion. We can look at reduced sensation. And in general, dysphagia is a symptom of many different conditions. And so sometimes it can be, many times in my experience, we see patients that have reflux. That's the majority of my patients. But dysphagia could be the beginning sign of some conditions, neuromuscular conditions that should prompt a referral to neurology. So we want to make sure that if we see things like atrophy, fasciculations, that we're referring to neurology. Doing the cranial nerve exam also, it saves us time when we're doing our test, which side, if the patient has weakness on one side, we know that we're going to turn to the weak side. But we want to have information about the cranial nerve exam so we know what strategies to use during the video if they're necessary. Mm-hmm. So then after we gather all of this information, many times we have to gather information from the patient and also the caregivers, because some patients have very poor insight into their deficit. So you also want to get the caregiver's impression, because sometimes it's quite different. Either the aide or the nurse that comes with them, or the spouse or the daughter or son, they may report things that are more severe than the patient's reporting. So once we have all of this information, then we proceed to do our exam. And I really wasn't planning to talk too much about the video swallow test itself, except for really, really advocating for that esophageal sweep. And really that it's something that I don't know that everybody does it consistently. And to be quite honest, we don't do it consistently many times because of patient characteristics is not safe. Many times I already have, it would not be safe for the patient, and I already have a similar exam that was done the week before, or it's going to be done later on that was ordered by the doctor. Sometimes the radiologists, mm-hmm. we really have to talk to them about conducting the esophageal sweep and their importance and address any concerns they may have, because sometimes they feel like this. There's one radiologist that told me it opens up a can of worms. Now we're looking at the esophagus and we may miss something, and it really is not meant to be diagnostic. It's as the esophagram is. We don't use the same contrast and we don't use the same protocol. However, it does give us important information about the interaction between the three phases of the swallow. And the both ASHA and the American College of Radiology support us using the esophageal sweep as part of our assessment so that it is complete and we can get all the information that we need. Mm-hmm. There is an interesting article that I found that's published in the American Journal of Speech and Language Pathology. It was published this year, and it's called Visualizing the Esophagus During Modified Barium Swallow Test. And that is a systematic review, and it covers some important information and considerations that we should keep in mind when we to include our the esophageal sweep in our study. So for this review, they included, it only includes five articles. They really looked at like 3,000 articles, but to include articles in a systematic review, there's a criteria and only five main criteria. But interestingly, they found that whenever there was a visualization of the esophagus, patients' esophageal findings were found in 48.67% of the participants. So that's quite high. And they also, there's been studies that have found a correlation between delayed pharyngeal initiation, delayed initiation of the pharyngeal swallow and esophageal findings. And also they have reported that, like we were talking before, when the patient presents or complains of globose pharynges, they point to the pharynx. However, they have, a lot of them have esophageal findings. One study found that 45% of them had esophageal findings and the other one reported 69%. So that's also quite high. And it allows us to also see how the three stages of the swallow are interacting. And we know there's a functional interrelationship between all three. So that is something that we should advocate for. And there are a lot of resources out there. There's a lot of articles supporting this. There's a lot of information and a lot of studies that suggest and reviews that suggest that we will be missing a lot of information if we don't do this esophageal sweep. And it improves how quickly we refer the patient, if they need it, to GI. It improves our ability to make a better diagnosis. For instance, many times, if we don't find anything in the oral and pharyngeal stages of the swallow, we may say the patient has dysphagia with unknown etiology. If we do the esophageal sweep, perhaps if we see reflux or retrograde flow, we call it, or retention in the esophagus, you know, we can refer to GI and mention those things in our documentation. One thing that you can mention to your radiologist, if they tell you they don't want to do the esophageal sweep, you can talk about perhaps the protocol that you're going to use. And the MBS-IMP uses a certain protocol to evaluate that. But for instance, in these five articles that were reviewed in this study, they didn't all use the same protocol. That may be a problem, but the radiologists, you know, the main problem that they see is that they're not going to report something that they missed. But I think in this article that I was mentioning, they say that perhaps they can include wording in the report that says that there was limited view of the esophagus and that this is not diagnostic. And if they want to, and they may recommend a full assessment with an esophagram if it's needed. Mm-hmm. All right. So we complete our study and it's time to interpret our results and discuss the results with the patient. As much as we like to think of instrumental assessments as objective, they are not. There's a lot of subjectivity to them, at least to their interpretation. And the MBS-IMP is a great tool that has standardized how we report the findings. However, based on how thorough of a history we have gathered, maybe how much we know the patient, if we also have seen the patient in the clinical setting, knowing the goals of the patient and knowing their estimated aspiration risk, our recommendations may vary. You know, there's a little bit of subjectivity that goes into it. The recommendations may still be very different based on a number of factors. These may include patient-specific risk factors for development of pneumonia, which we have kind of touched on before, how independent they are, and whether they have other factors that compromise their pulmonary clearance, whether they have other medical conditions that affect their health and their immune system, also based on patient goals, whether they have neurological conditions where maybe it's common to see a decline in function when they're fatigued, just to name a few. And So having that thorough case review does help a lot in making the appropriate recommendations. All right, so like I was saying before, many times the results of the video swallow study don't match the information that was gathered from the RSI, the reflux symptom index, or the E10, or you know, the patient reports certain symptoms that we don't see during the video swallow test. And we have to remember it's just a snapshot of what's happening. And maybe if it's happening once a day, maybe we're not likely to see it in 3 minutes with a limited amount of appeal. But then we have to think critically about, okay, so this patient comes to me with this concern that they have severe problems and this is really affecting their quality of life. And if you don't find anything, then you have to think critically about what could be causing the patient's symptoms, what kind of conditions could maybe increase the likelihood that the symptoms are going to happen. And sometimes you have to go back, and even after you gather all this information, you have to go back and ask questions about maybe when they take their medication. For those patients that are on seizure medication, maybe, or the patients with neurological conditions, that may be something that can have an impact. Perhaps how they eat. There may be patients that require assistance, but they want to eat by themselves and they eat very fast and they're not being supervised because they refuse. Some people just, they have the aide, but the aide says she doesn't want any help and she wants to eat by herself. And perhaps that puts them at higher risk. And sometimes for the patients that say that they have maybe a hiatal hernia or some GI symptoms, the symptoms may not show until they have had a larger volume. So we can think about different possibilities and maybe refer the patient to their doctors for further evaluation. If it's, I had a recent patient that it looked like it was really their seizure medication that was affecting his level of alertness at certain times of the day. And so he was referred back to the neurology so they could discuss that. This was a patient that was status post craniotomy. So the doctor will have to consider what can be done to improve that. We can have patients that have similar results in their video. However, the recommendations are different based on all of these factors. For instance, the patient that has consistent, let's say two patients have consistent aspiration of thin liquids. And one is a 75-year-old male who was recently discharged from the hospital, has COPD, and came with his aide who provides assistance for feeding and all ADLs. That patient is totally different than the patient that's consistently aspirating thin liquids, who drove himself to the appointment today, had to cancel his tennis game, and maybe has a few medical issues, maybe related to normal aging, but is otherwise healthy. So we have to estimate that the risk for pulmonary complications and risk based on all of those characteristics. Let's talk a little bit about our recommendations. And our recommendations, we need to be very clear in our report about what we're recommending. I use the ITSE terminology, and I use both terminologies, the SOLID, the name that most people use, and then the ITSE terminology also for those patients that are seen by therapists or they're going to facilities that use that. And I'm also very clear about the type of recommendations we're given in terms of compensatory strategies, the amount of supervision. If you see the patient's very impulsive and they have increased difficulty with larger volumes, then you may want to recommend supervision. Or sometimes we can also make recommendations to the caregivers about different assistive devices or the cups that deliver only a certain amount of liquid or certain things. Because we definitely want to increase independence for our patients. We know that dependency for feeding is the strongest predictor of aspiration pneumonia, at least in that study that was done in 1998 that included a lot of different patients in different settings. But we definitely want to increase independence for our patients. Now, if we need to recommend diet modification or even something like making the patient NPO, I like to explain the reason behind that to the patient, because as we do this a lot, so we may not think too much about putting a patient in nectar-thick liquids or making some other recommendations that may be more drastic. But that it may be life-altering for the patient, and we should give them some a good explanation as to why we're recommending this. And sometimes the patients will not agree with our recommendations, and that's fine. We are only making recommendations based on what we think is safer for them, and after estimating the risk of the for them to get pneumonia and to maybe have a poor nutrition and hydration and overall decline in health status. But the patient has the right to tell us what they want to do and to refuse our recommendations. And at that point, we need to just discuss with them what we think the risks are if they continue to eat the things that they want to eat, and maybe provide a lot of education on what things they can do to reduce the risk for pulmonary complications, things like oral care, maybe increase the strength of their cough, or based on the whatever assessment we have done of the whole patient, you know, what type of activities or things they can do to reduce their risk. If we recommend thickened liquids, I think it's also important that we recognize that we have to provide information on the negative effects of thickened liquids, which could be, it's common for patients on thickened liquids to drink less. There's a tendency towards dehydration in some patients. And that, I think that's more common in the patients that are dependent too. Maybe the risk of UTI, we have to discuss all of those things with the patient and make sure that they understand the importance also, especially, well, for all patients, but for patients that need to be completely MPO, the importance of oral care is critical so that we can reduce the risk of pneumonia. If they're aspirating thin liquids, they're likely aspirating their secretions. So it's important to discuss all of those things. It's a good idea to have a handout already made so that you can provide all of that information in written form too. Things related to the diet, any compensatory strategies, any other recommendations, and then also information about all of these things that we talked about before. As far as reporting your recommendations, our report needs to be very comprehensive and complete so that the next person that is seeing the patient, if the patient's going for therapy, or the patient may not need therapy right now, but it may be a report that stays in their medical record. And maybe in a year or two, if the patient had any issues, then they return for another video swallow exam so that we can do a comparison between the two. It's important to be accurate and concise and present clearly all recommendations as far as the diet goes, whether therapy is needed, and be clear about referrals that we're making and why we're making them. For instance, if we're saying that the patient we're referring for ENT, then we can just say what we're concerned about: dysphonia, reduced airway protection. If we're referring to GI, the same thing, maybe based on what we see or whatever the patient reports as well.
All right, good. Okay, so what's next? Where are we diving into?
One other thing to keep in mind is that effect of medication, which I have included a couple, I think there's one or two handouts in the show notes that talk about the impact of different medications on the patient's level of alertness or swallow function, reduced salivary flow and xerostomia that can have a negative impact on the patient's swallowing function. So just recognizing those, you know, perhaps the patient doesn't really have a dysphagia per se, but the effect of medication and for example, with xerostomia, we see it impacts the oral stage of the swallow, the pharyngeal stage, and even the esophageal stage. So it's important to recognize those. And the patients can usually tell you if they are experiencing those symptoms. Now, there are conditions, autoimmune conditions that will cause that, like Sjogren's, but if it's related to medication, perhaps we can just bring that up to the physician. And especially in the older population, many times the patients are taking a lot of medications. Some of them, if you discuss with the physician or the family does, they may be able to modify them, reduce the dose, but that's something that needs to be done by the doctor, but we can bring it up if that's causing a major issue for the patient. There are other drugs that cause excessive throat clearing or a cough. We know that the ACE inhibitors have that effect. So keep that in mind. And then there are some that will have an effect on the central nervous system, like the benzodiazepines and anti-seizure medications, narcotics, and antipsychotic medications, which are common with the older population and can really cause a drastic change in swallowing function. And once they're taken off, it's like night and day, then everything resolves. So looking at the list of medications and being knowledgeable about some of those side effects is important. So in the handout that I have in the show notes, there's a list of medications with names and type of medication and the side effects. There's a lot of information out there about different medications. Karen Scheffler has a good blog on that at swallowstudy.com as well that can possibly help with that.
Excellent. All right. So as we come to the conclusion of our talk today, wow, you've covered so much. You've gone through the SLP's responsibility, like the background knowledge, what we need to bring into the radiology suite with us when we're conducting outpatient video swallow studies. You've talked about what we do when we're in front of the patient in radiology, conducting that patient interview, using those open-ended questions, using patient-reported outcome measures like the EAT-10 and the reflux symptom index, conducting the cranial nerve exam and oral motor, the importance of the esophageal screen, and then the critical thinking, like what we do when we put all these pieces together and then how that influences the recommendations and how we coordinate with the patient on what's going to be feasible for the level that they're returning to. You know, if they're coming, they're a community dweller, they're coming from their house, or if they're coming from a skilled nursing facility or some other type of facility like that, like what's going to be the best recommendations to manage their symptoms and keep them healthy. And then on top of all of that, then you talked about the effect of medications and provided really good resources on being aware of what medications do, how they affect different aspects of the swallow, and as another thing for us to be aware of and place into our decision-making skills. So, wow, it's a lot, but it's good. I love it. Are there any more do you have a final thought, any other kind of summary that you want to leave us with today?
Well, since I have the fees perspective as well, and you reminded me when you said feasible, but fees is often a recommendation, not often, but sometimes is a recommendation after a video swallow test, or even after, not immediately after sometimes, but if there's persistent concern for aspiration, and the video swallow test was negative, but you know there's good reason to believe that the patient may be aspirating. AFIS is actually a good recommendation. And this happened to me in the acute care setting, and it happens all the time. Where I personally did a video swallow test for a patient with a stroke. He had a left frontal stroke, and he had expressive aphasia and apraxia. When we did his video, he had to, I think he was okay for nectar thick liquids and a mechanical soft diet. However, after I saw him at the bedside for a couple of days, I'm like, I'm still concerned. And so we got an order for fees. And sure enough, we saw a piece of meatloaf in his airway when he was feeding himself. So that's fees can give us a lot of other valuable information. So it's something important to consider. Those patients that present with poor management of secretions are also great candidates for that. And many patients will benefit from both tests so that we can do a more comprehensive assessment of their swallow function and get that whole picture, which sometimes one test gives us all the information and sometimes both are necessary to get the whole picture of what's happening with the patient and make the best recommendations for them to preserve their swallowing safety, efficiency, and improve their quality of life.
There's my golf clap. I don't know if the mic is picking it up.
Just as we are wrapping up, I just wanted to, one last thing is that we should always keep our patients' goals in mind when we are making our recommendations and their preferences. sometimes the patients want, they don't want to use a certain strategy, and they get referred by the patients that's treating them, and they don't like that strategy. They don't want to do that head turn. It's not natural. So we can, if that's the case, we can look during the video swallow study, we can look for strategies that work for them and they're going to be compliant with. But that's the beauty of the need to do the assessment of compensations under fluoroscopy or video endoscopy so that we can see if they're effective, if different ones work, and we can give the patient choices and respect their preferences so they are compliant with actually the compensations. Mm-hmm. And that's great.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Isabel. This was wonderful. I really appreciate all the work that you did to prepare for this talk and bringing together all of these amazing tools that you have for us in the show notes on speechuncensored.com. Like, they are so great. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great being with you here today.
And if people want to reach out and ask more questions or learn more from you, how can they find you?
They can find me on Instagram at Swallowing Specialist of Florida, or they can email me at swallowspecialistsfl@gmail.com.
Excellent. Good. Okay. So as I wrap up, I just want to remind our listeners that they can access those show notes on speechuncensored.com, along with the discussion guide, which has questions to continue this discussion that Isabel started today during our episode, for you to sit down at a table talk with other SLPs and just dig deeper into practice patterns and technical knowledge, clinical knowledge, and all those wonderful things, and just chit chat either in person or online. And those tools are available in the show notes. Also, if you could leave a review on Apple iTunes, that would be great. That helps other SLPs find this podcast and continue to nourish and flourish and learn right along with us. That's everything from us today. So thanks for joining us.